Very windy and cold, a high today only 10 above. This morning, wind out of the northwest at 22, gusting to 30 miles per hour. 4 above, Kenosha and Racine. 1 above for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Wind chill stands at 18 below. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I am very, very happy for the first time in 2016 to welcome back to the morning show for the first of his monthly visits to the program, Dr. Art Sear. Professor Sear is director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business, author of After the Cold War. You perhaps see his columns in places like the Kenosha News. Some of you may even hear his occasional appearances on Lake Effect on WUWM up in Milwaukee. We're grateful that he is such a regular part of WGTD's morning show. Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the program.
Thank you for the warm welcome on a freezing morning, as the cow said to the farmer in Wisconsin.
It was not a fun drive, you were telling me, that you passed all kinds of wrecks along the way, so we were glad you made it safe and sound.
Yeah, the American propensity for tailgating in our contemporary time, it really does result in a lot of accidents on icy roads.
Right. Well, one of the things I wanted us to talk about, there's a whole lot of things to talk about, from North Korea's bomb to China's stock market to deteriorating relationships between Saudi Arabia and Iran, what President Obama is likely to say tonight in his State of the Union address, and what he said in that very prominently covered press conference regarding guns and a whole lot of other things. I want to begin, actually, with something that you wrote right around New Year's, which carried kind of a central message that I think would be of no surprise to anybody who hears your morning show appearances, because this is a theme that recurs quite often in the way you sort of frame the various issues that we talk about. But it seems like a good way to begin this first morning show visit of 2016, talking about two really important ways in which you feel like, in general, the sweep of world history and the progression of world events is in a very positive direction, particularly in two very specific spheres. Tell our listeners about that.
Are the two spheres you're referring to the growth of market economics?
Yep.
I feel like I'm a student taking an exam here with Professor
right.
Berg. I'm glad I got the right answer. Yes, right. The growth of market economics and representative government,
right,
which is huge. That, in turn, has facilitated the quite remarkable rise of women to very active, not only political participation, but political power in widely ranging countries around the world, not only the developed industrial democracies, including notably us, where we don't have a female president, but I'm confident we will soon, and we have two very visible candidates who are women in each party. But also in Germany and in other countries, there have been notable women national leaders for quite a long while. Indira Gandhi in India,
Golda Meir in Israel.
Yeah, although obviously that's an highly advanced industrialized post-industrial economy and society. There are others, but the sheer volume of their participation is really tremendous, and there are all kinds of positive benefits that accrue therefrom. So thank you for mentioning it. I wrote an op-ed about, which I do pretty much annually now, about the good news developments in the last year.
I wanted to highlight one line in that column that I thought was particularly interesting, especially because I think it, in some ways, is very, as a word, I don't know, counterintuitive. It on the surface, it doesn't make, or it surprises us, let's just say that. Towards the end of this column, you said, reality, as usual, is more complex and more promising.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I found that so intriguing is because I think most of us operate with pretty much the opposite understanding of the world, that something seems great. I mean, yes, I won the lottery. Isn't that great? But the closer you look, the more complicated it is, and the more negative it is. The closer you look at something, the more you realize hidden costs or unforeseen consequences or whatever. The closer you look at something, in a sense, the less promising it is or the less good it is.
I don't think I wrote that in the column. The closer you look at things, the less promising they are.
No, you said the opposite.
Yeah.
You said that's what I'm saying. I'm saying most of us operate under the opposite presumption, that the closer you look at something, the more you see the warts, see the cracks, see the things that make it not so good. And you wrote, I'll say it again, reality, as usual, is more complex and more promising.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, you're saying exactly the opposite of what I just laid out, that at least when it comes to certain events or certain issues, we tend to, in a sense, look at things, but we're not looking for the hidden details. We're just letting the big headline loom larger and larger. And you're saying in these two issues you were writing about in this New Year's column, the closer we look, the more optimistic we should become.
The last couple of sentences you just spoke are particularly important. The media, good news headlines, does not sell newspapers. And Spiro Agnew, the column was inspired, at least metaphorically, by Vice President Agnew, who before he was forced to resign because of corruption, would regularly lecture the media on their shortcomings and emphasize the importance of stressing good news. But, of course, that does not sell newspapers back in that era, and it's still true today. The more sensational the news, the more likely over the short term it'll get attention. I, of course, was writing very grandly, broadly, collectively, as journalists and professors can do, more than some other people. But what you're referring to is the individual consumer, the individual relationship over time, individual life is very, very challenging. A good point you're making, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really appreciated that you said that, because I think, you know, as we've talked about before on this morning show, particularly if we're in the business of wrestling with one complicated, vexing issue after another, particularly certain issues, certain conflicts that seem to have absolutely no simple solutions at all, I mean, it's really easy to become completely discouraged with a sense that none of this is going anywhere near where we want it to go.
Yeah.
And you're really saying, despite these isolated incidents of that should be disturbing and are, that the general sweep across the globe is actually in a very positive direction.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm glad you mentioned the column. I wasn't expecting you to, but the holiday time is a time we all experience disappointment and depression to varying degrees, but at some different points in our lives, as you and I well know and our listeners know, disappointments, ironically, during the positive Christmas season tend to be often come to the forefront. I mean, statistics concerning suicide as well as hospitalization and incarceration demonstrate that. It's therefore particularly important, given that irony, to start the year on a positive note. Hmm.
Well, that being said, let's talk about some things that, at least on the surface, are not quite so positive, particularly if people own stocks. It was not a great year for the U.S. stock market. And, of course, recently it's been kind of a catastrophic few days on the stock market in China. Mm-hmm. And first of all, I think it's kind of intriguing. I think some of us who are still sort of left in the Stone Age, who don't follow just how dramatically China has changed, might even be kind of amazed that there's a stock market in China at all. Mm-hmm. I think there's plenty of us Americans who have only the vaguest sort of notion that modern China is not the same as Mao's China. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of us are uncertain about just to what extent China is a transformed nation with an economy that resembles ours. Can you just say kind of a general word about that, sort of what the Chinese economy is, and then what sort of the state of that economy is right at the moment? I mean, are these troubles with their stock market cause for alarm, according to how large the headlines have been here?
No. It's in the nature of markets that they go up and they also go down. China is going through a particularly challenging and painful long-term transition from a very harsh, truly totalitarian communist dictatorship not too many decades ago to still a controlled political system, I assure you, and our listeners, but a relatively open and competitive marketplace. It's a wrenching change. Deng Xiaoping, a communist, a very great leader in terms of seeing the need for change and implementing that in 1992, opened the door to this dramatic capitalist revolution which continues to unfold. Capitalism and industrialization inevitably are not pretty. They're wrenching. They break apart traditional societies. I dare say it's particularly difficult for a very traditional society that has had overlaid on top of that a communist dictatorship. Because state planning and state allocation of resources is still very, very prominent and apparent and important in China, the current downturn is a particularly serious challenge. President Xi Jinping and associates have made it very clear publicly that they are not going to panic. They're not going to aggressively interfere with the marketplace. They had a conference in early December, just before Christmas, 4 days before Christmas, which confirmed a report which remains secret, but they've been talking about it pretty openly about the need to let the marketplace develop and evolve. When you open things up, even if you don't have free elections, you are opening yourself up to public pressure. Over the last 20 years, several hundred million people in China have moved out of abject peasant survival, bare minimum poverty, to something like a reasonable standard of living with disposable consumer income. That enormous middle class is going to continue to grow. They're making serious demands on the regime. They want reasonable medical care, what Americans take for granted, however bureaucratic and expensive and convoluted our system is. They want good medical care. They want safe food. Mm-hmm. They want safe transportation. In the area of food, things that Americans have demanded and expected since the Theodore Roosevelt administration are now coming in China. They're very heavily overbuilt in basic industries, including steel, cement production, to some extent, I believe, rail transportation. Moving from these overbuilt and, in net terms, expensive, heavy traditional industries to a much more diversified, sophisticated economy is a huge challenge for them. They've also had a tremendous run-up in their stock market. I'm sure there's a speculative bubble that's now bursting, but given the tremendous and wrenching increase in their stock market, it's not surprising that things are going down. As usual, related to our earlier point in interchange, the media gives maximum emphasis to what's going on, but do take a look at the numbers. How serious a decline is this in terms of the global markets? According to futures this morning, especially in Europe, this is not a big crash in traditional terms worldwide. It's not a repeat of the Great Recession, which we initiated in our housing market about 6 or 7 years ago. It's not even a repeat of the dot-com crash at the beginning of the century. I don't want to sound like a Pollyanna, but this is not a global crash, and it's healthy. Markets are healthy, and markets do go down as well as going up, which is why dollar cost averaging, making your investments on a sustained, regular basis, is the way to actually make money over the long term.
Right.
So please be reassured.
Sure.
Brother Berg.
What about the matter of how much the fortunes or misfortunes of the Chinese stock market affect us? I mean, what are the tangible ways in which our economy is affected by events like that? I mean, or for instance, if those stock market troubles in China were even worse, I mean, there is a point where our economy begins to feel those reverberations.
Of course. Well, we already have.
And I'm curious about what exactly are the ways in which our economy is affected by those numbers in China?
Well, Greg, please keep in mind, I'm a college professor. I'm not some Wall Street wizard or brilliant, insightful investor. I do know a few things. It is good for us long term. It is good for us long term that the Chinese economy is going through this correction. Hmm. The reason why open markets are becoming pervasive in the world, a change from even a quarter of a century ago, is because they work so effectively. The average person does quite well, in contrast to communism, fascism, the Nazi nightmare, militarism. Various alternatives just don't work that well. It's not because capitalism is necessarily enjoyable or
perfect
short term, or attractive in any kind of abstract academic sense, but it does work. Therefore, for us, this is good. American corporations are very heavily invested in China, from Sara Lee to General Motors to just about IBM, you name it, quite apart from selling Lenovo. American corporations are heavily involved in China insofar as the market is becoming efficient and more productive. That's all to the good. It is the American and other foreign corporations in terms of their charters, leadership and ownership. They're the big money makers in China. The short-term dislocation, insofar as it's creating a more efficient market, one more like the good old USA, that's really good. In terms of people who also are not Wall Street wizards but do have some money to invest, be extremely cautious in any emerging market. They're far more dangerous. The risks are inherently greater than elsewhere. And finally, there are certain canaries in the coal mine that are useful. Hmm. Other Asian markets, especially Hong Kong and Taiwan, if you're really interested in what's going on in China, look at the degree to which those markets are affected longer term by what's going on in the mainland.
Hmm. One of the things I thought was interesting was as analysis was being made of those first especially rough days, was how China, whoever controls the stock market, instigated these sort of circuit breakers when it starts plunging too fast, and actually did it more than once in the course of a single day. And at least as far as the numbers played out, the use of that circuit breaker, which is in a sense to like, it's like halt the action and let everybody have a chance to calm down, evidently had exactly the opposite effect. Mm-hmm. that when trading resumed, the plunge was even faster, and the fact that those circuit breakers were utilized at all, in a sense, seemed to create more panic among traders than to lessen that panic. It was just kind of an interesting exercise in psychology to see how that kind of played out. And I suppose it's not that that doesn't play out maybe exactly that way on our own stock market, but I found that really interesting. I suspect there's even a bigger story behind that.
Well, circuit breakers meaning that the authorities stop trading is pretty widespread and today pretty pervasive in markets, including our own. I worked at the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations for 2 decades. We built the organization in real terms, working together, led by John Riley. He was very effective in dealing with the corporate leadership of Chicago, which used to be a pretty cohesive group of men and women. We happened to have a board meeting, heavily represented by senior corporate executives, in 1987 when the stock market plunged quite dramatically, very quickly, thanks to the growing importance of computerized automatic trading and automatic sell-offs. After that, circuit breakers came into U.S. markets as well. A lot of this speculation about, well, if the circuit breakers hadn't been there, panic wouldn't have been. A lot of it is media, basically speculation geared to making news and not just reporting news, creating headlines and selling newspapers or drawing people to your website.
Right.
We don't know what. I think the main lesson is these are communists and aging communists at that, even though it's a relatively younger leadership generation currently in place. Keeping hands off is very tough for people like that.
Right, absolutely.
And the fact that they're letting the market play out, I think, is the real news.
Yeah.
I hope that's clear.
Thank you for pointing that out. Speaking of headlines, North Korea.
Excuse me, at our board meeting, there was a lot of nervousness, and a lot of these characters were. they kept talking among themselves and getting, you know, beyond business. We did not have pervasive cell phones then, but it was big.
Yeah, I bet. Speaking of headlines, North Korea setting off what they're saying is a hydrogen bomb. And, of course, that generated headlines all across the country, or all around the world, of course.
Yeah.
First of all, were you surprised by that?
No, because every few years they've done one kind of crazy thing or another, whether it's a brutal, cruel execution or highlighting a captured American, currently allegedly a spy, or other foreigners, or it's another kind of nuclear explosion. They've set off several, or a missile test. They've been very erratic in the effectiveness of what they've done in technical terms. I gather from the news that we had a super high-tech reconnaissance aircraft in the air over the site before the explosion. And one can infer from that that we have very good intelligence concerning what's going on regarding North Korea, even though it's a closed system. And I'm sure that sanctions on North Korea, which are pretty severe and collective under the UN, will become more severe in the future. It's important to keep in mind that the armistice that President Eisenhower achieved soon after taking office in early 1953 has held. It's a tense border. There are violent incidents from time to time. But in basic fact, the terrible Korean War has not been reignited despite all the bad news and sometimes terrible news, and despite the bizarre, semi-crazy character of the regime in Pyongyang. I'm not in any way complacent, but I am impressed by the enormous strength of the South Korea-U.S. alliance and by our capacity to react appropriately to events.
I was a little surprised to read in the wake of this detonation that one of South Korea's responses to it was right along the border to apparently broadcast very, very loud anti-North Korean propaganda. I mean, broadcast over speakers right at that infamous border between the two countries, which I just found kind of intriguing. I'd never heard of that before.
Well, South Korea is it's kind of responding in kind. The North Koreans have been notorious, starting with the Korean War, and the Chinese, whom we fought directly in that war, for loudspeaker propaganda broadcasts incessantly, close proximity to very, very intense combat. During lulls in the fighting, these speakers would broadcast all kinds of simple-minded but pretty horrific propaganda. GI, you die, you know, the mantra of early Cold War.
Wow.
Propaganda that started from the other side. We've got to keep in mind that South Korea, in great contrast to the North, is a representative democracy. President Park Geun-hye, I think, has been an extraordinarily effective leader. She, another great example of a woman leading a nation. She, I think, has demonstrated great prudence, restraint, and good sense in dealing with the North. She also, they have term limits in South Korea, but she's a politician. The party wants to stay popular. I think this resonates very positively with the South Korean public. I think it's geared more toward them than toward the North. I've been going to Korea, South Korea, a country I really admire a lot, for different reasons since the 1980s, and I've been up to the DMZ several times, and you, on at least one occasion, I recall propaganda broadcasts from the North in Korea coming south.
Interesting.
Yeah, there's a long history there. It's definitely not just a stunt. It's heavy with symbolism, and it's politically significant.
And there's a history there that I was not aware of.
An awful lot of the Cold War was defined by the Korean War, I believe. It changed the Cold War from being Europe-centered and very much focused on Germany and obsessed with Berlin to an international conflict. It drastically changed our relationships with Taiwan especially, but also China in negative terms, and with Japan in positive terms. It's not much discussed. I didn't hear much about it at the time, but I believe I infer that our intervention in South Vietnam, about a decade after a little over a decade after the Korean armistice, was to a significant degree, I feel this very strongly, encouraged by the fact that we were successful in the Korean War, at least in defending the South.
Interesting. Because we sometimes don't think of the Korean War in completely positive terms.
We should.
I mean, we don't think of it as a resounding victory the same way that, for instance, the Second World War was. But
no, exactly. And that resonated in American politics.
It fed
the domestic communist fears and hysteria that characterized the Korean War period and 4 years afterward. It resonated.
Let's shift our attention to the Middle East and to what probably is...
We did successfully defend the South. I think that's what the American military officers, especially of that era... I believe that population was significantly defined by that success, that limited success.
Absolutely. I'm just saying, when we look back at it, I mean, just casually, we don't always stop to appreciate the importance of that.
Yeah.
So we think of it more as a stalemate, and it, of course, was more than that.
That's the way it was defined and discussed in American politics. You're quite right. And the great change in President Truman's image and reputation from very negative during that time and for years after he left office to extremely positive reflects the fact that with time we're able to have, I think, a more dispassionate and, I believe, objective evaluation of what his administration did and what they achieved.
Let's shift to the Middle East and what I'm pretty certain is the major story in the last couple of weeks, of course, namely the alarming deterioration of relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And, of course, these are two really intriguing nations with a lot in common and a lot of things that, that make them in stark contrast to one another. What is your understanding of the most significant elements of this disruption of their relationship, and what are the potential consequences?
Well, Iran today is the beacon, the leader, the most influential state in the region in terms of impact on the Islamic population in total. They're a fundamentalist regime. Saudi Arabia is not a modernizing regime. They're certainly not a representative democracy. But they are a status quo regime. They're not a revolutionary fundamentalist regime. Additionally, there is the fundamental ethnic cleavage rooted in strongly in religion and emotion as well as history between the Shia and the Sunni populations. And Iran is a leader because of the enormous size of the Shia population. A very imaginative, very influential political scientist at the University of Chicago, John Mearsheimer, a very independent, provocative thinker who enjoys that role, wrote an article as the Berlin Wall was coming down and the Soviet Union was disintegrating, why we will soon miss the Cold War, with the end of the basic, long-term, in hindsight, pretty stable confrontation with the Soviet Union, at least the defining confrontation with the Soviet Union and our respective allies. Other conflicts were more muted. With the end of the Cold War, there's been an opportunity for these other conflicts to emerge and become more virulent and more important. And I would see the Iran-Saudi confrontation in that light. They're both operating with some considerable restraint. I think that there will be kind of a reestablishment of more normal relations over time. It's certainly not going to lead to war. It's not going to lead to great violence. The most extreme Islamic radicals, ISIS currently, violent, virulent, insane, they really operate to create a broad coalition in favor of stability that would include Iran, a principal opponent of ISIS, something the American media seems to overlook, and also Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm. Given all the turmoil that is in that region right now, not just between, for instance, Saudi Arabia and Iran, but difficulties in Yemen and Syria and Egypt, for that matter, and that's just the start of the list, Iraq, you typically speak optimistically about the region as a whole in terms of the younger generation. You've said that on this program before, that is cause for hope in a part of the world that seems to defy hope in so many ways. I mean, there are so many ways in which it's difficult to be optimistic about the future of the Middle East. Just restate your case in terms of where you see reason for optimism in this troubled part of the world.
Well, first of all, the Middle East is always in chaos in one way or another, going back to World War II and especially the period just afterwards with the growth of nationalism. Sam Huntington, another distinguished political scientist, very different temperament, but he could also be provocative. He's very well known for his book, The Clash of Civilizations. It was an article on foreign affairs that became a book in the 1990s, and then after 9/11, it became a huge bestseller. He argued that there are fundamental cultural cleavages, including between Islam and the West, that lead to continuing conflict. He also did a book that I think is more important and even more insightful called The Third Wave, in which he argues, I feel quite persuaded, and the Third Wave has gotten almost no media or broad public or political attention. He argued that starting with the American and French revolutions, predated by the English Revolution and Civil War in the 1600s, that there's been a long-term growing trend toward democracy with occasional reversals. He dates a third wave of growth of democracy, dictatorial reactions, world wars interfered with this long-term trend over a couple of centuries. But he argued that beginning in the 1970s with the overthrow of military regimes in Portugal and Greece and the growth of representative democracy in those countries and others, a broad third wave of democratic representation was undeniable. He was writing, I think, around 1990 with some time perspective, and events since that time have only confirmed his point of view. The Arab Spring, to a degree, can be understood as the most recent eruption of turmoil, instability, and violence related to a broad democratic revolution. Even Iran, which is demonized so continuously in our media as well as political debate, even Iran does have elections. They have a highly educated middle class, including about 50% women, a very active middle class. The long-term trend is against either traditional monarchies or highly repressive dictatorships. It's a very dangerous time. I've never been particularly, I think, a serious shortcoming of our foreign policy leadership, not Secretary Kerry, but certainly Secretary Clinton and the President during President Obama's first term, were quite misguided in emphasizing, automatically assuming that the overthrow of dictatorships in Libya, for example, was opening the door to representative government. Especially in that part of the world, it's going to be a much more long-term and painful process. That's all I mean about being optimistic. During the Cold War, I quoted Mearsheimer, we had our close alliance with Israel, a very durable alliance with Turkey, which I believe continues and has been nurtured quite rightly by the Obama administration from the beginning. But the Soviet Union had its client states outside of Israel and Turkey, Arab states generally, were Soviet clients, and Iran before the revolution, which is not an Arab state, was a close ally of the U.S. I think that was a much more dangerous time, given the instability in the region, than today. We had a confrontation with the Soviets in 1973 during the Yom Kippur War. We had a confrontation involving nuclear weapons with the Soviets when the Israelis had an entire Egyptian army surrounded, thanks to Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger, we were able to both restrain the Israelis and deter the Soviets. But it was at least as dangerous as the Cuban Missile Crisis. It did not get played out in public. It got played out quite privately. But to me, that's always underscored just how dangerous potentially the region is. There's nothing new about current chaos, but there is a broad growth, I think, of representative government that's also slowly encompassing the Middle East and the Islamic world. I'm being kind of long-winded even for me, but you ask a really important question and also a difficult one. Indonesia is the largest majority population in the largest Islamic majority population nation in the world. They are a basically today stable democracy. They're a good ally of the U.S. They've been very helpful and effective, especially given their strategic geographic position in working with the U.S. government and allies in combating terrorism. Back in the 1960s, there was good evidence that Indonesia was moving into the Soviet orbit. They had Soviet army and naval personnel working directly with their military. They had Soviet sailors on their ships, including their submarines. A big reason why, almost never mentioned today, a big reason why we intervened in Vietnam again with substantial military forces in 65 was because of fear that Indonesia was going to fall pretty soon.
Wow.
It was a realistic fear then. Never mentioned today, rarely, even in the serious media. It's an extremely important country to pay attention to when you're concerned about, and especially when you're alarmed about Islamic terrorism.
We should make brief mention of something you wrote back in December. It was since your last visit to the morning show about an important agreement, I believe, being brokered between Israel and Turkey, two nations we talk a lot about on this program.
In, I think it was 2010, Israeli commandos quite unwisely attacked from helicopters, ships which were from Turkey bringing relief supplies to Gaza, which remains under Israeli if not immediate military occupation under Israeli control and, in effect, military blockade for security reasons. The Israelis attacked at night. Anything involving ships, helicopters, even in the daytime, is risky. Civilians were killed. Obama was effective in brokering a kind of personal rapprochement between President Erdogan and his government in Turkey and Prime Minister Netanyahu. There was a what prompted the op-ed was there was an important but not much reported meeting in Geneva in December between representatives of both sides, and clearly both Israel and Turkey are moving back toward reestablishment of diplomatic relations. The point of the article, and I've actually gotten an academic journal article published on this subject, the strategic importance of Turkey remains for us extremely durable, extremely vital. In some ways, they're more easy to deal with than our close Israeli ally. And this is, again, an extremely important development that's beyond the headlines. Thank you for mentioning it.
A couple other things that we'll try to talk about as time gets away from us. President Obama recently initiated some executive orders around the divisive issue of gun control. Where do you see that issue headed?
It's actually a very continuing issue in American politics, at least since the assassination of President Kennedy in November of 1963. There have been strong public pressures to use federal law to restrict guns. And the goal is laudable. After Robert Kennedy was assassinated in 68, I was still a student. I started giving money to Handgun Control, which has evolved into the Brady organization named for James Brady, who was severely wounded when President Reagan was shot. I did it, even though I was a student and didn't have any money in terms of disposable income. So I certainly share strong feelings on the subject. President Obama's executive actions are things that can be reversed by Congress with a sympathetic president. It's undeniable that whenever he makes a statement or issues an executive order on this subject, that I must say the president's becoming almost frenetic and issuing all kinds of executive orders during his last months in office. What he does is he spurs tremendous increases in gun sales. In that literal sense, I think the president's actions are counterproductive. It's very difficult. It's easy for academics to talk about. It's extremely hard for the president and the Congress to work together. Our founders wanted it that way. But I'm very sorry that this particular president has, in effect, now for quite a long while, abandoned any kind of serious dealing in personal terms with congressional leaders. I think that's the most important point. We also have a huge black market in small arms in this country, especially handguns. It's large, it's growing, it's tragically and in a very bloody way represented by the constant killing in Chicago, which has very strict gun control regulations, as does Washington, D.C. I think that whatever the president does, that reality isn't going to change, except that gun sales in the legal market are going to increase. I dare say they're increasing in the black market as well, but that's so huge in this country, and the killing is so pervasive, directly related thereto, that it, I think it operates independently of what happens in Washington.
Right. It's so frustrating when you look at charts.
I'm sorry to talk that way, especially on public radio, but I think particularly in public broadcasting, that's an important point to make.
It's so frustrating when you see charts of the developed world, and you see the charts of, you know, in terms of per capita, how violent these nations are in terms of gun violence, and how the United States dwarfs the rest of the world in this regard. I mean, nobody else has the problem that we have with gun violence, whatever you think should be done about that. And, of course, it's possible to have very, very different opinions about that, but there's no question that there's an incredibly something seriously wrong. I can't imagine anybody arguing with that.
Yeah, but we do need a different approach.
Right.
From we do need a very different approach from what's currently going on.
Right.
As I say, I believe it's counterproductive.
Right.
We also have a far we do a far better job of having reasonably equitable law enforcement and a relatively uncorrupt legal system in this country than in most of the countries of the world. That's an important point to keep in mind. The context in which this problem exists, maybe that's the main point I'm trying to make. The context is really important.
Yeah. Let's finish with something that hasn't yet happened but is expected to happen, namely the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court is expected to hand down a decision in the next few days, I think, which would in effect strike down unions' rights to insist that public employees have union dues taken out of their paychecks, despite whatever their feelings might be about that particular union. There are indications, anyway, that is the decision that the Supreme Court is likely to hand down, which of course would be quite a blow for organized labor, which is already reeling from a number of different setbacks. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the decline of organized labor is striking, isn't it? We obviously, when it comes to social issues, which you might call lifestyle issues, the Supreme Court has been willing to move in quite reformist directions or liberal directions. When it comes to economic matters, it appears that the court does have a more reliable conservative majority. Justice Anthony Kennedy, who clearly relishes and publicly relishes his role as swing vote between left and right, he therefore has become particularly pivotal. But in economic matters, we've got a Supreme Court that seems to be moving much more like the pre-World War II Supreme Court, when there was a lot of rigid conservatism when it came to economic concerns.
That was the Supreme Court that FDR was so frustrated with. Right?
Yes. Well, he tried to pack the Supreme Court, and he's universally condemned for that. However, the court started to loosen up after that and started to approve New Deal legislation, which they had previously condemned. I believe very strongly that precedent is important, that Supreme Court justices especially should not be celebrities, even though today they are. I believe very strongly in the importance of the union movement. My second job, I was a trade union member, and believe me, I learned the importance of being a member of a union and dealing with at least certain managements. A big problem today, in contrast to the past, is we don't have politicians on the Supreme Court. What we have is activists, ideologues, academics, as the court has become highly politicized in partisan terms. Earl Warren was a politician, over and above everything else, and a very successful one. Eisenhower, contrary to what he said on one occasion publicly, Eisenhower was very wise to appoint him. When he became Chief Justice in 1953, Brown versus the Board, the basic desegregation decision was on the docket. It was going to be 5-4. We're used to that today in terms of crucial cases. Earl Warren put a hold on that case. He spent an entire year. He had a few other things to do, as did the court. He spent an entire year working on the justices, other justices, their staffs, the wider political context. So when Brown versus the Board, the most important decision since World War II, I believe, there have been other very important ones, including Roe v. Wade, but Brown versus the Board, it was 9-0. It was 9-0. We condemn politicians. We get sarcastic about them. Obviously, today, there's a lot of public hostility to politics, but to me, that shows the importance of a working politician getting things done.
Absolutely.
And making our system work. Brown versus the Board, and Earl Warren's tremendous legacy, not just on civil rights.
I'm glad you mentioned that. That's something lost.
I'm glad you brought up the court.
Many.
Yeah, you took me by surprise. There.
Right.
That's a very good one. Thank you.
Right. Well, we will be able to talk about that more thoroughly at your next visit, and we'll also talk about El Chapo, Joaquin Guzman, next time. And there's a little presidential race to talk about, but we are out of time in the meantime. Yeah, so, Dr. Art Sear, I'm glad we could have you here for yet another really interesting hour. Look forward to seeing you in February.
General John Kelly of the U.S. Marine Corps, in charge of the Southern Command, including Mexico, read his comments in the media about security in the hemisphere. It relates directly to El Chapo.
Okay. And we'll